Welcome to the Jazz Legends podcast, which was born out of the Jazz Evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. This week we feature the music of the legendary Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington, born April 29th, 1899. One of the most prolific composers this music has known. His body of work is unmatched, both in quality and quantity. The knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear are Gunnar Biggs, Keith Bishop, Joey Carano, and Bob Weller, and the talk is moderated by me, your host, Father Doran Stambaugh. Dig it. Okay, let's talk about Duke Ellington. St. Michael's is going to have a concert of sacred music that you guys are going to play at coming up on February 4th. So we can talk about Duke and about the sacred music, his sacred music concert, and anything else. So the first question, who's Duke? What makes him important, and what contributions has he made to the jazz canon?
Oh, he's like one of the most amazing, multi-talented composer, bandleader, raconteur of all time in jazz music, I think. If he had only just done what he did writing American popular songs, he would be like a giant in the music field. But that was just the tip of the iceberg of all the things he did. He was a great piano player from the time when they had all these old-time guys like doing cutting contests in people's houses to show who had the most chops playing the piano. He was in on the end of that scene. And he parlayed that into being like a songwriter that he wrote all these songs that they're still playing and still recording to today. All those years ago, he wrote those songs. And as a matter of fact, that's what financed his band all those years, because his band stayed together for all these lean times when there wasn't really a demand for big bands. And he managed to parlay his publishing income into paying his band members.
All right.
He used to say, to keep a band together, you have to have a gimmick. And my gimmick is I paid him. So
pay the band.
Yeah, because he had guys on his band like Kerry Carney that was about the only band they ever played with for like 40-some years. And Johnny Hodges and Cootie Williams and Cat Anderson. All these people stayed because they were being paid. And they loved the music, but they were being paid well. And he used that to his advantage because he wrote for these personalities, and they really were personalities. Some of these guys like were very difficult people to be around, I think.
I heard with Mingus, he says, I'm not going to fire you, but I'm going to demand your resignation or something like that, because he got in a knife fight on the stand.
Yeah, that's something I don't think he tolerated.
Yeah.
But he put up with a lot. He put up with a lot from people. I there were several times I went to see the band where he'd start the night. There were maybe 8 people on the bandstand. There were some guys that weren't going to go out until so-and-so went out first, because I have seniority and I'm not going to go out there before he goes out there. And they'd play chicken in the wings. Like, you going out yet? No. You know? So like they'd have like 3 saxes and a smattering of brass and part of a rhythm section. And sometimes at the beginning of a night, I saw the band a few times. I was going, what's going on here? But it's funny. It's like some of those personalities. I heard Johnny Hodges was just completely impossible to deal with sometimes. If he didn't dig you, he'd be up there trying reeds while you were playing a solo or something. Like, yeah, I don't like that one. And I heard when they were in Reno, he used to be playing Keno all the time. And if his number came up, he would, at the middle of a tune, he would get up and go collect his winnings and then come back.
That was like, my band. I should have played that band.
What was the thing you said people stayed together so long in the band that they started talking to each other again?
Well, that's the old joke. Yeah. That I found that to be true when I was subbing on Broadway with Chicago. The show has been running 20-some years. And one night between the matinee and evening, I was hanging out backstage and I asked the drummer, like, so is it really true? Like that the show's run long enough that people started talking to each other again? He says, you know, there was a whole year I didn't speak to the bass player and we just wouldn't speak. And then one day I just said, this is silly. I'm going to start talking to you. And that's what happens on bands that have been together forever, you know. But it's a joke besides, a true joke, apparently.
You know, another thing about Duke is that he did cross over from keeping the Apollo dance floor full 2 shows a night, you know, for strictly entertainment value and keeping the gig. And then he broadened out into writing bigger pieces, and he got more concert oriented. So it was really, he tried to keep current with what was going on, keep the band employed. And 2 things I was amazed at. Somebody recommended I listen to a CD called Money Jungle. Money Jungle, I get it. It's Charlie Mingus, Max Roach, and Duke Ellington. Now, these are two very modern players, right? And he sounds like Thelonious Monk on some of these things, very sparse and rhythmically punchy. He wasn't trying to make people dance. You know, and another one, Duke Ellington and John Coltrane, which is amazing. Completely different style there. So he was really into keeping current by still keeping his identity too. And then, you know, from the Apollo to Carnegie Hall and everywhere in between. And then the sacred concerts brought him into the church world. You know, there was an Episcopal church, there was a Catholic church, there was a Methodist church. It was non-denominational. Mm-hmm. But he brought in, again, with the entertainment thing, tap dancers, choirs, soloists.
I was saying earlier that I was surprised when I watched the Sacred Concert by how show busy it was. Yeah. I expected it to be more reverent or something, and about notes and harmonies and stuff. And that was there. But but the tap dancing and the singing. And
some of the lyrics are intended to be humorous, too, which is kind of odd for a sacred piece of music. The recitative that you're going to do is sort of tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. Back to his publishing, supporting the band. I mean, and I only know, you guys know a lot more about him than I do, but some bits that I've read, or maybe they're, it's a stereotype of him, that he was known for borrowing, hearing and borrowing different pieces of melodies and things that he would pay. They would come from the band and he would pay the band for them. But then he'd work with them to compose. And so in a way, this is like a full circle thing. He's getting some of his composing from the band, and then the band can live off the publishing of his tunes.
I kind of think that's Terry Teachout's take on some things.
Okay.
I'm not sure I agree with completely. Okay. But I do think that he really wrote for the people in his band, because he knew what their personalities were and the kinds of things that they could do well and maybe not do so well, and feature their strengths and not their weaknesses.
Okay.
And he started a whole sort of a trend for being band writers writing specifically for the people that are in the band. It was kind of hard on some other road bands because they didn't have people there for 20 and 30 years that they put a personal stamp on the proceedings. But there's a period of time that a lot of big band writers, instead of writing the name of the instrument on the part, would write the name of the person that was sitting in that chair.
All right.
And I did that some when I was on Woody's band, when we had the same people.
I want to ask a question. I have heard that a lot of the parts, the section parts on Duke's band, were not written out. They were just sort of evolved over years.
Yeah, I went to see the band where they didn't ever open a book.
Yeah,
me
that's
too.
What I thought.
and I kind of think some of the nutty voicings that you see in the transcriptions, or pause, the guys kind of made it up on their
just
own.
Just made it up.
Because the part had been lost, and they didn't know what it was.
Plus, I think, you know, we should mention Billy Strayhorn, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had a partnership for 30 years. If you're going to talk about composition, you know, I mean,
it's funny. Speaking of the Sacred Concert, the first piece in the Sacred Concert is what is it?
The Beginning God.
In the Beginning God. So I read a thing not that long ago that said that Duke was on the phone with Billy Strayhorn and he couldn't figure out how to start that, you know, what melody to use. And he said, what would you do? And Billy Strayhorn called him back like a few hours later and said, this is what I'd do. And so Duke said, yeah, okay.
I heard the same thing.
But it's not in the music that way that Billy Strayhorn contributed that phrase or whatever.
Yeah.
But Billy was on the payroll, and it was like, I think a lot of what Billy did was not really credited.
Yeah.
Another thing I didn't know is that on the first Sacred Concert, when Billy Strayhorn accompanied Lena Horne, that was the last time he ever played in public.
Yeah, I saw that too.
That's the last time the notes that he played in public were on that first Sacred Concert with Lena Horne. And then two weeks later, he was in the hospital.
What's the Take the A-Train story? Isn't that
Well, that was supposed to be like scribbled down notes of how Billy was going to get to Duke's apartment in Harlem when he came after he hired him out of Pittsburgh. And he wrote a song based on that. You must take the A train to get to Harlem. It's the fastest way to get to Harlem. Oh, okay. and that later became the theme of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, the theme song.
Billy Strayhorn wrote
A Train.
Right. Right.
And I think he wrote a lot of stuff that is kind of in a gray area, whether he and Duke collaborated or whether he wrote it and Duke put his name on it. And I'm sure, from what I've read about Billy Strayhorn, you know, he was a gay man in a time that it wasn't really accepted to be a gay man. And he was bankrolled by Duke, apparently, to live the lifestyle he wanted to live and write music in New York and have the friends he wanted to have. And nobody looked askance at him, at least of all Duke, even though Duke was really an affirmed ladies man. But
one of the things I love about jazz that I'm mesmerized by is that players like you guys can meet somebody cold. Maybe you don't even speak the same verbal language, but you can sit down and there's a canon and you can call a tune and a time and a key and play and have this relationship, and it's wonderful. That's, and a group of musicians play together for long enough and you get to know each other, then that makes the music that much deeper and more interesting, and the conversations and the trust shows in the final product. And it sounds like with Duke, that's something that happened with the band, that there's the level of the players, but also the long-term relationship that otherwise you couldn't get to maybe the stuff that they were able to achieve. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, he knew all those voices so well that he knew what he would write that would make them sound good.
Well, he must have been a good manager, though, too, in general, paying them correctly. And then when they mess up, maybe he wasn't so hard on them. Created an environment they wanted to stay. And create an environment for people like Billy Strayhorn to create, you know?
Right. And he actually made the band a business.
Yeah.
You know, he had Helen and Stanley dance. Helen Oakley Dance was his publicist for 40 years, and Stanley Dance was his right-hand man for those 40 years. He was on the bus, he was on the planes, he was like the road manager. So he delegated, I think, intelligently.
But I do know people came and went. And even his primary partners, Johnny Hodges, and they were upset and they left and things weren't quite right. What was Jess Stacy in that, I don't know what documentary, he said, it happens and you can't avoid it. If you become a band leader, you become a prick.
Different skill sets, though, right?
He was talking about Benny Goodman, by the way.
Well, you've heard the stories about Benny Goodman.
Yeah, yeah.
The night that he died, one drunk player called up the other and said, I've got good news and bad news. Oh, really? The good news is Benny Goodman is dead. The bad news is he died in his sleep. Supposedly a true story.
Do you guys know who were Duke's influences? Any influences that he had coming up?
I think Debussy and Ravel, right, were big influences, and all the stride players.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I did hear that he was compared to Stravinsky and Bartok, but I don't hear that. Yeah. I hear those other guys way more.
I don't hear Bartok,
the French Impressionists. No. Yeah, and so I think those were just people saying, listen to this, it's heavy, it's like classical music, you know, sort of thing. But I hear the impressionistic.
Yeah, harmonically. But it's funny, like, he sort of set the style for writing for big bands. Huh. There weren't that many people that influenced him doing that. He sort of paved the way and figured out what to do on his own. I think a lot of what he did musically was like autodidact.
I wish I could talk to him now, because it seems like he was very influenced by Duke Ellington.
Oh,
are you familiar with his
writing?
One
of many people that were very influenced by
That's him. The next question. Who did Duke influence? Who didn't he influence?
Like everybody.
I mean, it seems like everyone claims that he had an impression.
Well, I think if you write for a big band, that's part of where you're coming from, is what Duke did.
Even the guys like Miles and Dexter Gordon, you know, said that when he was 7, I think his parents took him to a Duke Ellington concert and it changed his life. You know, he knew he wanted to do that or something like that.
Miles Davis said something to the effect that, like, there should be one day a year that all musicians pay homage to Duke Ellington.
He needs a feast day.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Just one real quick thing. Yeah. I got to hear the Sacred Concert personally when I was at a point in my life. I was a young player in high school, and I didn't know whether I was going to go into orchestra work. I knew music, but jazz or whatever. And it was in San Diego, November 22nd, 1970. And I got to sit right in front of the rhythm section. And from the downbeat on, I said, I know what I want to do now.
You mean with Duke?
I wasn't playing with Duke, no.
No, but you saw him perform?
Oh, yeah, it was the full-on jazz Sacred Concert.
No way.
And I was sitting right in front of Jeff Castleman, the bass player. I forget who was playing drums then. The rhythm section did fluctuate quite a bit. He changed bass players and drummers around. But I just sat there with my eyes like saucers the whole time. I could see and hear everything. And I said, this is what I want to do. Not necessarily big band, just creative music.
That's American. The feel of that music.
Oh yeah, it swung so hard.
Yeah.
I saw this one. I'd never seen this video before. I just watched it the other day, and they had the drummer that was Duke's drummer and Elvin sitting next to him playing another set. Two set drummers playing the swing thing. What the hell?
Well, in one of those videos, it's Joe Jones slapping like a book or something.
Yeah.
Along with the Duke band. And
he had pawned his drums.
I remember somebody said something like, that's the first time Duke's band ever swang or something. Because I know there was always this rivalry between the...
A lot of people were down on a lot of Duke drummers over the years, especially the early years. Is it sacrilege to say anybody in Duke's band didn't sound very good?
Any other personal experience with Duke or tangentially personal?
I had an experience with Cat Anderson once, which was very cool. He was on the road with the Ice Show, Ice Capades or Ice Follies, I forget
who. Cat was
on the road. Cat was on the road with the Ice Show.
Sorry. Who's
and
Cat?
And this was before Cat Anderson, who was one of the high note trumpet players, not necessarily lead trumpet players with Duke's band forever.
Okay.
For a really, really long time. Anyhow, so he was out on the road with the Ice Show. And this was before I had even gotten to start to play the Ice Shows myself. But the trombone player in our college band was playing the Ice Show. And he said, you know, Cat Anderson's a really nice guy. I think he'd be willing to come over and rehearse our band if I ask him. And I says, oh, that'd be so great if he would. And he did. He brought him in, and Cat was so great. He rehearsed the band, and he played. And he was so beautiful and so encouraging, and you know, like, and on his night off, it's like, really, don't you, you know, you really are willing to do that? He was such a sweetheart that he donated his time essentially and came over and rehearsed our college band. And it was, he had a lot of good insights too.
I've got a second tear down where we were doing, when I knew Stanley Dance really well, and we, the jazz faculty at San Diego State, did you play one of them? We did three jazz sacred concerts.
No.
USD, the Methodist Church, and Point Loma. Anyway, we did three performances of it, and Stanley Dance called me and said, would you mind taking me to one of these performances? I'd like to hear what you guys are doing. I said, sure. So he lived in Vista. Stanley Dance lived in Vista. So we pick him up, and he was just really, he went up and talked to us how we had honored the music in an honest way, good, and you know, we were a lot of integrity about the music. And people were like, God, Stanley's heard this thing forever. But he was really complimentary about it. The fact that he says, you guys are keeping this music alive. Nobody's doing this anymore. Mm. You know, so that's the closest I got to Duke. That's once removed.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Did we talk about his music enough? What do you find unique or interesting about his playing style composition? It sounds like there's a breadth there. There's not much he couldn't do.
Well, they're still being played every day. Satin Doll, Don't Get Around Much Anymore. I mean, these things I just
played. One of
played.
The things that stands Take out to me is that for Take years it, they yeah, told you the that A-train. Popular songs had to be easily singable.
Oh,
and
right.
Sophisticated Ladies Bridge is so like intervallically complex that it's hard to imagine that it became a popular song because it's all over the place, and especially the bridge. Da 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 da. It's like, I'm sure the average person off the street's not going to sing that after hearing it the first time.
And what's that reoccurring theme in the sacred concert?
Come Sunday.
Yes, the Johnny Hodges version. So many chromaticisms. I wonder if that was written or if he just included them.
That was John.
He pieced everything together with halftime.
That was part of his style, like the scoops
and
the.
God, he sounded so good on that thing.
And stuff.
I think. I like all that. What do you think of Johnny Hodges? Are you into him?
Yeah, well, I'm going to try and emulate him on the concert.
Okay. Oh,
come Sunday. Yeah, I've been practicing so people can point and laugh. That doesn't sound like Johnny Hodges. What's he doing?
What's wrong? What's wrong with that guy?
I've heard him play before. He doesn't sound like that. Yeah. No, but he was completely unique. You know, supposedly he studied with Sidney Bechet.
Okay.
So that's where he got some of that.
Oh, wow.
Bending notes up and down. Yeah.
I found a quote that said, Ellington is one of those rare artists who wrote music that appealed to both the masses and those interested in fine art. Does that sound?
Well, yeah, definitely.
That's kind of a trick too, isn't it, with jazz in general? It's somewhat bifurcated. It's like the danceable stuff was one thing, but then when it morphs into bop, it's sort of lost a bunch of people, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, he never really morphed into bop.
He stayed
like sort of swing era centric. Well, he was one of the only band leaders that was still using like clarinets and stuff, like in his new compositions up through the 70s even.
What would be an example of his work that would be considered fine art versus or I guess that they're saying, this is saying that a single tune could appeal to both. I suppose that's what the point is.
I think even his like standard songs, that right. songs that have become standards, could be like considered art songs or considered popular songs.
Yeah,
especially the ballads.
Well, and I just recently listened to Mood Indigo, which is one of his big and early hits, right?
Yeah.
And it starts out pretty simple. I mean, interesting, but it goes harmonically some places. And I think that was the original.
And the way he orchestrated it is really cool, too. Yeah. There's one section that has two muted trombones and bass clarinet.
It's like, awesome, and it gets
nobody
really
was doing
heavy.
That.
It starts out as, okay, this is a nice song, and then it continually changes and morphs into something that's different from in my opinion, having just listened to it again.
He voiced awesome. Things differently, too. He would put the Barry above the tenor a lot of the times.
And I've wondered over the years whether some of that happened by accident, that they lost the parts and they just ended up playing it that way. Because, you know, there's almost no written music left from Duke Ellington.
All right.
Like, a lot of the stuff that people play now is transcribed from recordings. Oh. On the road, like, music doesn't hold up very well. And over 40 years, you know, like, even when I was doing Buddy's Band, half the book looked like the Dead Sea Scrolls and Woody Herman's Dance book was almost unreadable. It was all crinkly and dried out and taped. So I can't imagine Duke's book after, like, from the 30s up to the 70s, you know, like, the parts that were still there were probably unreadable, and the ones that weren't there were lost 20 years before because the same guy had been playing that chair forever and they didn't need the music anymore.
Any recordings you'd recommend to a first-time listener or someone who wants to dip their toe?
I'd say listen to Mood Indigo, you know, right off the bat.
I'd go for tune titles.
I'd suggest to listen to the 50s band first.
And then go to the decade. 50s. Yeah. Find the tunes you like.
Because when I first started hearing the band live in the 70s, I was continually disappointed because a lot of those guys were getting too old to actually function the way they needed to function in that band. And I don't know. It just wasn't very tight anymore. I think just because a lot of those guys just were beat. You know, how long can you be on the road anyhow? You know, like, I was on it for 3 years and I was
about
killed.
To kill you. Yeah.
But these guys, 40 years on the road, like, doing mostly one-nighters, it's like, I don't know how they managed it at all.
Any other resources to learn about Duke that you'd recommend?
Well, there's so much stuff on YouTube to listen to the music.
Oh, Stanley Dance.
Yeah, I've got under the DiCapo books, there's The World of Duke Ellington by Stanley Dance. And it's not just a biography. The way Stanley worked with these things is he would interview different people. Here's Cootie Williams. And he would ask him about Duke and playing with Duke. And so you get insight from the musicians instead of from some guy that went to the library and read a bunch about it and is compiling facts
for a
biography. So The World of Duke Ellington by Stanley Dance, I highly recommend.
Okay,
that's awesome. And then there's, you know, YouTube is this wealth of information these days. You can watch actual interviews of Cootie.
There is a really nice recording of the first Sacred concert in its entirety on YouTube.
I watched some of it.
Yeah.
Duke's autobiography is kind of interesting. Music is my mistress. Not so much from an information point of view, but it gives you an insight into Duke's character a little bit and the way he thought about things.
Say something about his character. That was another question here.
He was really attached to the people in his band, and it becomes clear when you read Music Is My Mistress, because there's little vignettes, like chapters, devoted to different people that had been in his band and talking about what they meant to him as friends and things like that. And it gave you a little more of an insight into, like, the person. He was basically, like, a really warm, like, nurturing kind of person, I think. Mm. At least that's the impression he tries to give in his autobiography. But it's kind of a flawed book, too, because it doesn't really give you, like, a picture of Duke from outside. It's, like, just his take on things and take on music and different people that he'd been with. But it's still interesting because it's first person and, you know, he's not around anymore to talk about things. So it's kind of a cool book.
Well, should we say anything about the Sacred Music concert that you guys are going to do? You're going to pull a couple different pieces from... He did three of them.
He did three of them, one in 1965, one in 1968-9, and one in 73. And they did a lot of them. But again, like I said, that has several vocal soloists, a tap dancer, full choir. In fact, in Europe, they did it with Swingle Singers.
Oh, awesome.
If you know the Swingle Singers. But we're just going to try to do an instrumental adaptation of that. We don't want to go high budget. There's no... I don't know who would choreograph.
That's a lot of stuff, all that stuff.
It is. Yeah. It was. That's why when you mentioned that it was an entertainment, this was during the era of the jazz mass.
Right, right.
You know, Michael Row the Boat Ashore up there during the, and he didn't want to go that direction. He wanted to say this is serious music that can be used in a sacred context.
Right.
And so we're going to try to do that with a, you know, non-denominational spin, because he didn't really declare this to be a mass or anything like that.
Right.
But do honor, because the tunes are so great, we can play it with a trio, a quintet, a big band.
They hold up.
They hold up.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we're going to include two additional tunes that weren't originally from the first sacred concert. One, I think it was done on the second concert.
Yeah. Heaven. He added Heaven for the second one, and Black and Tan Fantasy.
I think and that was where originally Come Sunday came from. It was like a suite that he wrote for the concert they did in the 40s at Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm. He borrowed a lot of tunes from his existing library to kind of...
You have as big a library as he did. It's a lot to borrow from. But right. Come Sunday has always been one of my favorite tunes.
And he does Come Sunday twice in the first one.
Yeah, he does it
David
as David.
Danced is do da do boo da. Ba-da-da. And the first one is a ballad, same chords.
Is that
the tap
where the yeah tap
that's the tap dance? So that's Come Sunday Fast.
And John Hendricks was he in that first one?
I don't think so. I think he's second.
The one I saw was with John Hendricks, and he had a beautiful little ska singing thing, and a lot of pitter patter in the background. That guy never stops.
I guess it's a conviction that music in general is a spiritual thing. I think you guys are. I mean, would say the same, you know, and jazz in particular, in and of itself as a form, is spiritual. And so, you know, for him to write these tunes and play them in a church, I suppose there can be an intention in the writing, but even still, or even if there isn't an intention in the writing, like playing that stuff in a sacred space, it's putting it in a context that's already there anyway. So I'm thrilled that
the Duke Ellington Concert of Sacred Music is free and open to the public, and will be performed February 4th at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.